Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
The former president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, is under house arrest as he stands trial for allegedly plotting a coup after losing an election. He's facing a possible 40-year prison sentence.
Things are pretty intense in Brazil in that sense, legally and politically, because of all these events.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll also hear from an American Army vet who worked as a security contractor in the Gaza Strip. He says what he saw there was disturbing.
Bullets are flickering all around the feet, into the berm, over their heads. And then this guy that's there just drops to the ground, and he's not moving.
Plus, a much-loved movie in India gets re-released. Audiences are angry it's not the same.
It's literally regressive to go back in time and bring a story without context to fit into a society that's not the same anymore.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. Jair Bolsonaro, the former president of Brazil, is now under house arrest. The country's Supreme Court issued the order yesterday. It's part of an ongoing legal saga, the coup plot allegedly engineered by Bolsonaro after his defeat in the 2022 presidential election.
The high-profile trial of the far-right leader has gripped Brazil. It has also attracted the attention of President Donald Trump. He calls the case against Bolsonaro a witch hunt. The Trump administration has also slapped sanctions on the Supreme Court judge overseeing the case. To better understand how Brazil got to this point, we reached out to Rafael Ioris. He teaches Latin American politics at the University of Denver. He told us the house arrest came after Bolsonaro, with the help of his sons, violated a previous order to stay off of social media.
They recorded some images that his son posted, you know, during the rallies. He actually sent a message to some other members of the extreme right party in Congress to have a message from the main leader to the rallies of the extreme right in Brazil. And the justice believes, you know, he's disrespecting my order. So I'm going to escalate a little bit on the punishment.
So what are the conditions of his house arrest?
So before, as you said, ankle bracelet, he could still leave the house, you know, during sort of daytime. Now he cannot leave the house, right? House arrest, which means he's not supposed to leave the house. He certainly cannot give any interviews. But his party now is very, very now even more motivated to actually, you know, support him. And they are making some signals in Congress that they're going to react against this. And they're actually pushing an amnesty law to provide amnesty to Bolsonaro, but also, you know, other people that were behind this attempted in Brazil in January 23. So things have become even more polarized and sort of divided in Brazil politically.
So this all does go back to 2023, when Bolsonaro allegedly planned to overturn his electoral loss to Lula da Silva, who is, of course, the president now. What exactly is he accused of?
So the current main trial in the Supreme Court, which is supposed to be resuming this week or next week, and people expect that by the end of the year there'll be a sentence, that it's because of this attempted coup that took place in January 8, 2023, a few months after the election that he lost. So thousands and thousands of people went to Brasilia, financed by supporters of Bolsonaro, very wealthy Brazilian, you know, business people, and they invaded the Congress, the National, the Supreme Court, and the Presidential Palace. So since then, a lot of people have been arrested, people that actually were caught in doing that, the violence, you know, the violent acts. And now people are saying there's enough evidence that Supreme Court believe they should take the case, that Bolsonaro and his close supporters, stimulated and incentivize people and call people to do those actions, and hence they are complicit or responsible for actually, you know, the violence in the destruction.
Is the allegation that Bolsonaro actually organized or orchestrated or directed others to organize this coup, or that he only encouraged people to do this?
Well, it's both, I would say, because encourage you know, repeatedly, even as president, he kept saying, you know, I need more power to run the country. We maybe need to think about imposing a military, you know, government in Brazil. He was a former military guy, very much supported and aligned with some of these conservative generals that he brought to the presidency when he was president. But also that they found documents that they were planning the coup. There's actually this document, which is kind of the coup plot, you know, document, which is where they really listed, you know, what we're going to do, how we're going to do, who we're going to arrest. And in that document, there are different copies that they found in people's, you know, houses, some of these generals and some of the people close to Bolsonaro. They listed that they would kill Lula, they would kill the current vice president, they would kill this main justice, Alexandre de Moraes, who is the one who sent this now here to house arrest. So things are pretty, you know, pretty intense in Brazil in that sense, legally and politically, because of all these events.
So the Trump administration here in the U.S. has weighed in at this point. The president set 50% tariffs on imports from Brazil, and he specifically linked that to the prosecution of Bolsonaro. The White House calls it politically motivated. The U.S. State Department has criticized the Supreme Court justice overseeing the case. What can you tell us about the relationship between Trump and Bolsonaro?
Well, they met as presidents. They coincided a few years when they were both presidents at the same time, and they met, and they have this very close ideological affiliation, affinity, family connections. Currently, one of the sons of Bolsonaro, Eduardo Bolsonaro, who is a congressperson, is on leave from Congress and lives in the United States, lives in Orlando, where they have, you know, a residence. And he was actually at Mar-a-Lago at the day of the election of you know, when President Trump was was elected to come back to office. So they have this family connection, this ideological connection, affinity. And I think it goes beyond that, in the sense that I think Trump also sees a kind of vindicating Bolsonaro, you know, ending this trial, sending everything away as a way to reinforce, you know, his own legitimacy in the sense, you know, they see, especially Bolsonaro, see him as a kind of the Trump of the tropics, the mirror image of Trump. But also, I think, in a sense, it works in the reverse order, right? It's a sort of reproves again the point that see, there's nothing wrong about these events.
What has the reaction been in Brazil among the public to President Trump's actions?
In a general sense, I would say the majority of people, that some polls actually were made, you know, are supporting the main sort of response from the Lula administration, which was to say, look, we are open to dialogue. We want to negotiate. We're very happy to discuss tariffs, but we are not going to allow, you know, a foreign power, as powerful as the United States is and historically, you know, main influence in the country, to tell us how to run things in our judicial system, right? So it's a very problematic matter, because how are you going to negotiate commercial deals if there's a strong political demand? So that leads to a very complicated situation between, you know, U.S.-Brazil relations at the moment.
Rafael Ayores is a professor of Latin American history and politics at the University of Denver.
In Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu hinted today at wider military action in the already devastated Gaza Strip. This comes as tens of thousands of Israelis, along with many former Israeli military and intelligence officials, are calling for an end to the nearly 22-month war. Former Prime Minister Ehud Barak spoke to Sky News, calling the operation a war of deception.
It has nothing to do with the security interests of Israel. It has nothing to do with the future of the hostages, probably risking them.
Barak says the war in Gaza is a purely political action intended to keep Netanyahu's shaky coalition government together. The prime minister currently leads the most right-wing coalition in Israel's history. Netanyahu and his cabinet are getting criticism for another thing. They voted unanimously on Monday to fire Israel's attorney general, who has been overseeing Netanyahu's ongoing corruption trial.
Meanwhile, more devastating images are coming out of Gaza as aid organizations carry out more airdrops. An officer in the Belgian Air Force, Lieutenant Colonel Steven van der Voorst, was part of a team that routinely drops one-ton pallets containing food, water, and medicine out of a cargo plane.
The situation on the ground is critical. It's apocalyptical almost. It leaves a real impression. So we need to be professional and keep focus on the mission to do that correctly. It's not the most efficient way to deliver humanitarian goods to Gaza, but for today, for this week, this is the only effective way.
The Israeli government's campaign in Gaza has made it difficult to safely deliver aid on the ground. The Belgian Air Force flight was accompanied by journalists who filmed the Gaza Strip from above. Much of the territory is flattened. Yesterday, dozens of Palestinians were killed or wounded while scrambling to get food distributed by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, a group established by the U.S. and Israel. Since May, several hundred Palestinians have been killed while heading toward food distribution sites and aid convoys. That's according to witnesses. The Israeli military says its forces have only fired warning shots and disputes the death toll.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Aguilar worked for a GHF subcontractor. He says violence at food distribution sites is part of a deeper problem.
The process doesn't work because it wasn't designed to work.
Aguilar spoke with The World at length earlier today, and he described not just dysfunction at food distribution sites in Gaza, but potential war crimes that he says he witnessed right there.
Live ammunition, lethal ammunition being fired from an assault rifle of a UG Solutions contractor who's standing on the berm in front of me.
We've got an extended interview with Aguilar about what he experienced as a security subcontractor in Gaza. That is later in the program.
The re-release of a popular movie in India has some people riled up. That's because the big film studio behind it decided to make a significant change to the beloved drama, a new plot twist right at the end, generated by AI. It was done without the knowledge or consent of the director. As Namrata Kolachalam reports from Mumbai, it has set off a fierce debate about the new AI ending.
These are the last lines from the 2013 film Ranjana. Kundan, the male lead, is on his deathbed, talking wistfully about his unrequited love for Zoya. 12 years ago, this final scene left audiences feeling conflicted, sad, even disturbed. But a few days ago, the film was re-released in select theaters with an entirely new AI-generated ending. In this Tamil-dubbed version called Ambikapati, just as Kundan appeared to be dying, his eyes popped open. Audiences have had strong reactions. The meme Akram from Chennai was one of those moviegoers cheering along in the crowd. But he still felt deeply conflicted about the film being re-released without the original team's consent.
We felt uncomfortable and bad because director is the one who brings the characters to the real life. He is the mastermind behind this.
In fact, Dhanush, the actor who now comes back to life in the film, said the new ending stripped the film of its very soul, while its director, Anand L. Rai, called the situation nothing short of devastating. For its part, the production company insists that this re-release is a respectful reinterpretation and that it has the legal rights to modify the original film. This has led to a debate over whether legal rights translate to moral rights. For film critic Bedatri Chowdhury, the new ending was problematic, in part because of what came before it.
All these years on, what has definitely stayed on with me is the depiction of an extreme toxic kind of masculinity.
Here's what she's talking about. Kundan, the guy who dies in the original movie, has been obsessively pursuing Zoya since they were kids. And his pursuit takes some extreme and arguably violent turns. Chowdhury says the new AI-generated ending, where Kundan survives and people cheer, could signal that this is all okay. She also notes that Zoya is a Muslim woman and that Kundan is a Hindu man, at a time when Hindu nationalism and anti-Muslim sentiment have been rising in India.
It's literally regressive to go back in time and bring a story without context to fit into a society that's not the same anymore. But it's also politically regressive because those things are potent in the India that we see around us today.
Chowdhury and many others are interested to see whether the re-release of Ranjana is an inflection point or if this is a one-off. For some, the answer is clear.
It is an aberration which an attention-seeking company has put out in the public domain to essentially garner outrage likes.
That's Chaitanya Chinchilagar, vice president of one of India's leading film schools, Whistling Woods. He doesn't mince words. The new AI-powered ending is a gimmick. And it's sending the wrong message to artists.
You know, artists basically say it's been a good ride, but I can't do this anymore because of AI.
That's Ben Zhao, a professor at University of Chicago. He develops tools that millions of visual artists have downloaded to protect their work by making it hard for AI programs to train off of it. But, he says, the fear of having their work co-opted is turning many young artists away.
So that's produced massive drops in enrollment at arts colleges and sort of disrupting the entire creative pipeline of training for all sorts of creative endeavors.
Chaitanya Chinchilagar says every generation of filmmakers has grappled with how to use new technological tools.
The most critical aspect right now in applied AI for media and entertainment is to bring in the creatives. And what they're trying to do with Ranjana is the surest way of driving creatives away from AI.
Audiences in a few Indian cities can judge the altered film for themselves. But it's clear that the fight over how to use AI in film is just getting started. For The World, I'm Namrata Kalachalam in Mumbai.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The wildlife in Thailand is a study in diversity. Elephants, primates, and wild tigers are all a source of national pride. There is one native species that is not so well-loved, though. It is, in fact, despised. But a group of young Thais want to convince people that this four-legged creature is not as repulsive as some think. From Bangkok, The World's Patrick Nguyen has the story.
What?
Witawat Ratanakon, a 37-year-old Thai man, is calling his pet to come out and say hello. The pet, named First, because it was the first of its mom's litter, is a little shy around strangers. It's hiding under a table. Finally, out it comes, a monitor lizard, big as a Labrador retriever, slithering towards us on its belly, its leathery skin scraping along the hot concrete. Witawat, a goateed guy covered in tattoos, looks on like a proud dad. Then he picks it up, all 55 pounds, and holds it like a baby. This lizard has some serious claws. He says, if I'm careless, he'll scratch me, but if I'm not, he won't. First is a water monitor. He looks like a cross between an alligator and a snake. And in Thailand, they're not exotic. They're commonly spotted in canals or sewers. Most people see them as giant, scaly vermin. Frequently, in Thailand, clips of monitor lizards invading someone's house will go viral. Here's a lizard running into a first-grade classroom, sending students climbing onto their desks. Monitors are so hated that the Thai word for these lizards, hia, is a curse. Something you say when you stub your toe. Calling someone a monitor lizard can start a fist fight. Witawat thinks this is unfair. He says, look, cats and dogs are sometimes mischievous too. Witawat runs an online group for Thai people who love monitor lizards. The group has 4,500 members and rising. In part to provoke change, they'll sometimes meet up in public, flaunting their lizards, walking them on leashes. Witawat says people are shocked, but we talk to them and try to educate them. This campaign has a long way to go. Disgust towards monitors is almost ancient. Historically, Thai settlements are based near streams, the monitor lizard's prime habitat.
And when people died, of course, a water monitor would be one of the first ones around to start feeding on whoever died.
Michael Koda is a biodiversity researcher with Thailand's National Science Museum. He's a reptile specialist. Monitors, he says, like to eat carrion, dead things.
Carrion's much easier to get a hold of course, because it doesn't run away.
As a rule, Koda says, monitors won't intentionally bother humans. They'll only bite to defend themselves. But if you do get bit, it's nasty.
You have something that's eating dead animals, you're going to get a lot of bacteria and pathogens passed on from their mouth into your wound.
So, raising a dog-sized lizard notorious for dining on the dead. A good idea or a bad one?
They're not easy to take care of. They need large areas. They eat a lot of food and they need a lot of care.
But Michael Koda says it can be done responsibly and that it's rewarding. A monitor lizard, he says, is pretty smart. It can tell people apart, retaining its fear of strangers but growing fond of its caretaker. A veterinarian in Bangkok, Ton Thanatsak, told me he is seeing more young Thai people bringing monitors into his clinic. The vet says it's kind of hip now to keep a monitor as a pet. Lots of people just want to make content, he says, and put cool photos online. The edgy appeal of cuddling up with a beast deemed wretched by society is compounded by the fact that owning one is not exactly legal. Under Thai law, the monitor lizard is a protected species, mostly to prevent commercial farms from raising lizards to make shoes or belts from their skin. It's midday, time for Witawat to hose down his pet lizard. First, and Witawat and his wife and young son all live in a small house in a crowded area. So there's no stream for First to dip into and regulate his body temperature. After the bath comes lunch. Witawat wets the lizard's appetite by clicking metal tongs. Sometimes First eats dead white mice. Today, he's getting raw chicken thighs. He has tiny snake-like teeth, but his jaws easily snap bones in half. Before I leave, there is a question I have to ask Witawat. Has First ever bitten him? Yeah, Witawat says. The lizard bit me once when it was little, but I wasn't upset. He says First was just following his instinct. He insists that, these days, that wouldn't happen. But First is still wary of me, and when I put my face too close to his, he warns me, back off. Message received, First, loud and clear. For the World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
That story from Patrick first aired last summer.
In Lilongwe, the capital of Malawi, a chance encounter brought the Madalitso band together. It was 2002. The country was in the midst of a severe famine. Hundreds of Malawians were dying. It was under these dire circumstances that Yosefe Kalekeni and Yobu Maligwa left their respective villages in search of a better life in Lilongwe.
Kalekeni was walking around the city, a guitar strapped around his shoulders, when Maligwa stopped him, introduced himself, and asked, "Why don't we join forces and start a band?" Now, with three albums, an appearance at Glastonbury, and a BBC recording session under their belts, the duo has just released a new song on Afera Chiboda.
In Malawi, Anafera Chiboda means chicken feet. The Madalitso band was inspired by a Malawian proverb about this traditional meal and how it represents simplicity and frugality, and that for a marriage, wealth is less important than the emotional connection between two people.
A documentary called The Banjo Boys is helping introduce the Madalitso band to new listeners. It tells the story of the group's rise to the worldwide stage. Their latest album, Magitala, came out in June.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
At least 6 people were killed today while trying to get food in central Gaza. They are among hundreds of Palestinians who have been shot and killed in recent months in chaotic scenes at food distribution sites run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the GHF. The joint U.S.-Israeli operation has faced harsh criticism since it began operations in February.
Anthony Aguilar is now among those critics. The retired lieutenant colonel served in the Army for 25 years, including deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq. Aguilar worked in Gaza and Israel this spring for the subcontractor UG Solutions, which runs security at GHF food sites in the Gaza Strip.
That was in May and June, before he parted ways with the organization, a separation that we'll get into in our conversation. Aguilar spoke with us earlier today from North Carolina. I asked him to explain where military contractors were positioned in Gaza.
The Israeli Defense Forces, about a kilometer away from the site, will hold the crowd back until the aid is on the site and the delivery trucks and the delivery personnel are off the site, so they're not in any type of risk or danger. Once that's complete, the IDF move out of the way. They usually hold the line, which is a military corridor along the coastal road of the Mediterranean that comes into southern Rafah. And they usually hold that line with tanks, utilizing small arms fire, machine gun fire, fired at the crowds, feet of the crowd to keep them back. And once they release that line, the entire crowd, you know, any given time, sometimes 6,000, sometimes up to 9,000 or more, in one mass rush come towards the site. It's, if you can envision in your head, like the start of the Boston Marathon or the start of the New York City Marathon, just this massive rush where the fastest, the strongest get to the front first, they get there first. Having been on the other end of it on site, pre-opening and then during opening, you can hear the growing crowd begging to be let go for food. The growing of the crowd in the distance, it's kind of unnerving because you know that you're there on this site and there's only 22 to 24 people there securing a site and you have potentially thousands of people coming to your location.
So let me just ask you something, because you said security fires at the crowd, almost as if that was anticipated, almost part of the job, but that can't possibly be part of the real protocol, is it?
From the Israeli Defense Force perspective, I don't know what their written protocols or what their written operating procedures are. But I do know that in practice, that the shooting at the civilians, shooting at their feet, shooting over their head, sometimes just based on the nature of terrain and the crowd, the bullets go into the crowd. That is a standard practice. That happens almost as if it was a rule to which it is supposed to happen. From the UG Solutions perspective.
And UG Solutions was a subcontractor for GHF that you were part of, correct?
Correct, sir. UG Solutions is the subcontractor for Safe Reach Solutions, which is the subcontract to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. So it's kind of like this nesting doll of contracts. You know, the inner doll of that, so to speak, is the UG Solutions security component, specifically subcontracted for armed security for protection of the aid on sites and to the sites. Because we as UG Solutions contractors, we were given no rules of engagement. We were provided without any clear standard operating procedures. We weren't trained on any non-lethal munitions, stun grenades, tear gas. We weren't provided any escalation of force measures, nor did we did rehearsals or go through with the leadership, you know, how that would look like in terms of engaging with a crowd of that size. So what UG Solutions personnel did is pretty much just adopt the ways of the IDF, which was shooting at their feet, shooting over their head. And what's been said in numerous occasions by not only the attorneys for Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, but also by the official spokesperson of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, that the contractors you know, shoot at their feet, over their heads, and sometimes out towards the sea. If you're a UG contractor and you're shooting out, quote unquote, towards the sea, the entire coast of Gaza, from the north to the south, the entire coastal road is just inundated with hundreds and thousands of people who are queuing from the north to wait for the opportunity to go to these different sites. So if you're a UG Solutions contractor shooting live ammunition as a means of warning or communication, you are putting civilians in danger. You're shooting into a crowd of people. So those practices that were adopted were just very uninformed, very, very negligent, high risk, and to be quite frank, are violations of the protocols of the Geneva Convention. Firing at unarmed civilians, using live ammunition to fire at them for the purpose of controlling or moving them, is verbatim a violation of Geneva Convention.
War crimes, is that what you're saying?
Yes, they are war crimes.
On paper, what was your job?
So when I first got hired initially, when UG Solutions first hired me, I was hired as an independent security contractor. After the second day in Israel, I stepped up, so to speak, to take on a planning role because they didn't have anybody in that role, which was shocking to me that they didn't hire anybody into this critical planning role. By the 21st of May, I was promoted to the Joint Tactical Operations Center team leader. 5 days after that, the second in charge of the entire contract in country from UG Solutions resigned in protest over his concerns with the performance. So I was offered that job and put in that job. So I was promoted twice, two pay raises within a 9-day period.
In other conflict zones or situations where you've done similar work, how did the training and preparation compare with what you were doing in Gaza?
Well, the training and preparation we received was zero. No rehearsals of the actual process of distribution. We didn't do any collective planning by bringing all of the contractors together to inform them, like, this is how this is going to work.
Nothing at all. They didn't, like, give you a YouTube video at least?
Nothing. We didn't get a YouTube video. We didn't get a briefing. We got no training on crowd control or riot control procedures. We were given an arsenal of non-lethal munitions, stun grenades, tear gas, pepper spray, rubber bullets, batons, and never given any training whatsoever on how to employ or use any of those things. Nor were we given any training or briefing on the escalation of force or what our legal authorities were. And to remember, we were all there on a tourist visa.
A tourist visa?
That's correct.
I understand you saw some disturbing stuff in Gaza, and you filmed video of at least one troubling incident, and I'd like us to hear the audio of that video, and then I'll ask you about it.
That might be the only option, keeping them
All right, some screaming there at the end. I think you hit one, and then somebody else screamed.
Yes.
Tell us what was happening there.
So that was on the 29th of May, and that was at secure distribution site number 4. Distribution had ended for the day. All of the civilians were off of the site. Gates were closed. Security had pushed to the perimeter. There was no one on site. One of the additional jobs I was given was to film and take pictures of everything. So as I'm walking through and I'm filming the berms, and you hear the first guy yell, that's the only way to keep them back. None of the voices in the video are mine. It's other contractors. And then the shooting starts, and it kind of startled me because I didn't know what we were shooting at, because we aren't authorized to use lethal force, i.e. pulling the trigger of your rifle, warning shots or not. We aren't allowed or authorized to use any type of shooting or munitions against the civilian population just to control them or scare them. We can only use munitions.
And that gunfire we heard was live fire? You know that?
That gunfire that you hear is live ammunition, lethal ammunition being fired from an assault rifle of a UG Solutions contractor who's standing on the berm in front of me. In the beginning of the video, as I'm first turning, you see a contractor that's running in front of me right before the other guy says, I think that's the only way to hold him back. That guy runs up onto the berm, and he's shooting from the berm towards the exit lane of the site. You know, that shooting that you hear is not an accidental shot or, you know, just a warning shot. He shoots quite repetitively.
Let me ask you a few questions here. So first of all, these, you're certain, were not IDF personnel?
These were absolutely, without question, not IDF. The IDF aren't physically located on the site or with us at the site. And I'm on the site. Mm. I'm inside of the site. And the audio itself has been validated by other media outlets to show that's not from a distance. That's not an Israeli weapon system firing. That is the type of weapon that we were issued, which is the IWI Arat assault rifle.
I'm speaking with retired Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Aguilar, who worked as a security contractor in Gaza for UG Solutions, the company providing security for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. How did you know for sure that this was indeed what was going on, targeting or pot shots taken on Palestinian civilians?
Myself and another gentleman are standing about 2 feet from each other. My rifle was in my right hand, and I'm pulling security, and I'm just kind of panning with my left when that happened. Right. You hear the guy next to me, he says something like, I think there's an F word, there's an expletive, and that's the only way to hold him back. What he's talking about is pushing the civilians back over the bridge. There's a bridge that comes over from the town into our area. But pushing civilians back over the bridge or security outside the site is not our responsibility nor our authority at all. So when the guy on the berm, who you can't see in the cut of the video, but he's standing on the berm and he starts shooting and you hear it, and then you hear the insightful calling of the woohoo, and then the other guy on the ground says, I think you got one. The guy that says, I think you got one is in front of me in the video wearing a hat, walking around. But that guy and I, we saw the same thing. What happened as this guy's shooting, at the very end of that exit, it opens up. And that's where the Palestinians were. Some of them were dragging their bags because they were heavy. Some had stopped to sit because it was very exhaustive and they're not wearing shoes and they're starving. They walk slowly. They stop to sit. They stop to get their stuff organized before they continue on their 8 to 10 kilometer journey. And this guy starts taking warning shots at them to get them to continue to move. And bullets are flickering all around the feet, into the berm, over their heads. And then this guy that's there just drops to the ground, and he's not moving. And he didn't move. And then you hear that gentleman say, oh, I think you got one. What he's referring to is that got one is a Palestinian, unarmed civilian that dropped to the ground. Then the other guy respond, you hear him respond with that, hell yeah, boy. They were celebrating it. That was not the IDF shooting. That was not the IDF in the area. The IDF weren't even on the southern part of the berm.
We should add here that your former employer at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation says, quote, no Gazan civilians have been shot by UG Solutions personnel, period. Your reply to that?
That is an ignorant and negligent falsehood. There's video proof of it.
I mean, the fact is the violence at these sites has been happening just about daily and has killed many hundreds of people. At its root, Colonel, why do you think this is happening?
The sites themselves were built deliberately with intention in active combat zones, so where war fighting is going on.
I mean, isn't all of Gaza a combat zone? So, like, what is the option?
No, because within Gaza, you have areas that are being contained and secured, but there's not active fighting. These sites were put into locations where there was active offensive combat operations.
So Israeli officials say the crowds are infiltrated with Hamas fighters and that Hamas instigates this violence. Did you see evidence of that?
No. So again, I have asked the question before, what is Hamas? Do they walk out and wear a Hamas t-shirt? Do they have a name tag? Never in the entire time that I was there and worked at all four of the sites did I ever encounter or see anyone dressed as Hamas in a Hamas type of uniform, anyone proclaiming to be Hamas. I didn't see any type of organized resistance, never saw a Palestinian carrying a rifle or a gun, never experienced a threat, never experienced any type of hostile behavior. And I didn't just work one site. I did all of the sites. Beyond that, though, is that let's just say, for sake of argument, if a Hamas fighter was in the crowd and they're wearing a distinctive uniform to say we're Hamas, well, they're a combatant of the Israeli Defense Force. But in terms of us, our position on the ground, we aren't combatants. We do not have the authority to kill a quote-unquote identified enemy. We are not fighting in the war.
You left your job on June 13th. The GHF claims you were terminated for misconduct and did not resign. What in fact happened?
So I did resign on the 13th of June, and I provided it not only in writing. I provided it over – we were directed and dictated that we would use signal chat messaging for everything. So it was provided to the leadership, and it was provided in writing. They say they fired me. I have never received, nor have they ever produced, any documentation to show that. I have all the documentation that counters what they are saying in terms of my performance. They promoted me twice in the time that I was there.
So you must know that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was controversial from the very start. What were your expectations when you took this job?
I took this contract and went on this job because I really felt that based how it was explained to us, that we were going to make a difference to feed people and to provide food to a starving population. I felt that was a noble cause that I wanted to be a part of. Upon getting there, I soon learned that it was anything but that. On the 26th of May, the day we started distribution, the start of the project, cutting the ribbon, so to speak, the executive director of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation stepped down, Jake Wood. The day we began the operation, the guy in charge of the entire thing stepped down in protest to how the thing was being executed.
There was a recent investigation by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. You're probably aware of it. It cited unnamed IDF soldiers and officers alleging that commanders have issued orders to shoot at unarmed Palestinians waiting for aid, even when they pose no apparent threat. Did you see any evidence of that?
Well, I saw them doing the shooting. Did I personally hear or was I present for that order being given from IDF officers to IDF soldiers? No. But based on the actions of the IDF soldiers, shooting into the crowd, shooting at the crowd, shooting at the civilian population, it would indicate to me that, yes, that wasn't just one or two people doing it. That was some kind of collective guidance.
And you were certain that those soldiers were in IDF uniforms?
Yeah, well, they were shooting from IDF tanks, from IDF positions, okay. IDF uniforms, IDF vehicles. Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt.
So you've said in the press that you joined this operation because you believe there's crucial work, life and death work, to be done to prevent starvation in Gaza. You are a security expert, but I wonder, since you've been on the ground and seen that it doesn't work, whether you have any thoughts about how to actually get these people fed.
The process doesn't work because it wasn't designed to work. What needs to happen if we're truly serious about feeding the population and safeguarding the civilian population, the UN process needs to be re-energized with the funding, with humanitarian assistance corridors, not militarized corridors, and not humanitarian assistance displacement villages or camps, humanitarian assistance corridors that are secured, where the trucks can move into a site without being worried about being ransacked, to a point where they can then deliver in scale. If there's only one point delivering, of course, hundreds of thousands of people are going to go to that one point. So the process that can work, we already have the mechanism, we already have the elements in place. And plus, with the United Nations, you get people that are experts in humanitarian assistance, doctors, veterinarians, nurses, teachers, nutritionists. Because humanitarian assistance isn't about here's some food. It's also about sewage surveys or this pump's broken. We need to fix that. So yeah, the UN mechanism needs to be reinstated, supported, and actively supported by the international community.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Aguilar. In May and June, he worked as a security contractor in Gaza for UG Solutions, the company providing security for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
You heard us asking Aguilar about his departure from UG Solutions. The company states emphatically that he was fired for misconduct in June. Together with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, UGS issued a video briefing last week. This is UGS legal counsel David Panzer in an excerpt from that video.
Warning shots have been used to disperse crowds. But contrary to what Mr. Aguilar says, no UG personnel have ever directed warning shots at civilians. On the ground in Gaza, warning shots are directed upwards, in the air, and towards the coastline, not towards folks seeking aid. Let me be clear, the allegations from Mr. Aguilar regarding the use of force are false.
In the same video statement, GHF spokesperson Chapin Fay called Aguilar a disgruntled, terminated employee.
And let me be clear. Mr. Aguilar's statements are not only false, they are distracting us from our mandate, which is to feed people.
We have extensive coverage online of the war in Gaza and the deadly scenes at food distribution sites that have killed hundreds of Palestinians. You can find that reporting at theworld.org. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Earlier this hour, we spoke with politics professor Rafael Ioris about former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro being put under house arrest. Bolsonaro is on trial for allegedly masterminding a coup plot to remain in office, despite his defeat in the 2022 election.
A Supreme Court judge says that Bolsonaro violated an order that he shouldn't spread information during his trial. That is what landed him under house arrest. This is top news in Brazil right now.
There is another story from South America's biggest economy that we want to tell you about. This one has to do with financial crimes. Just last month, we saw the largest cyber attack against financial institutions in Brazil. At least $100 million was stolen from several banks.
It's just the latest example of rampant online crime there. Gisele Rigatau reports from Sao Paulo on why Brazil has become an epicenter for cyber crimes, large and small.
The Cybercrime Police Division is located in downtown São Paulo.
This unit was created in 2020. They have about 60 officers and only deal with organized cybercrime. Guilherme Gueiros, a lawyer with the firm Opus Bloom, is sitting in the waiting area.
Pelo menos uma vez por semana eu tô aqui batendo ponto.
At least once a week I'm here, clocking in and clocking out, he says. His firm represents companies that have lost tens of millions of dollars through cybercrime. He says it's getting worse.
Vertiginosamente, a gente vê que...
Dizzyingly, he says. We see that the attacks are getting more complex, more targeted. The hackers are getting better prepared, and the challenge for us is increasing. Gato says some investigations take years, and only 30 to 50% of their clients get some money back. Renato Topan is one of the deputy police chiefs of the cybercrime division.
Há volume muito grande de golpes e a gente não tem estrutura para investigar.
There's a huge number of different schemes, and the police can't investigate them all, he says. They investigate 1,000 cases at any one time. Topan won't say exactly how they go after criminals, but he admits only about 60% of cases lead to indictments, lower than other crimes. Topan says it's easy to open a bank account in Brazil, and there are many online banks. He says organized criminal gangs often hire poor people to open accounts.
A maioria recebe um valor para emprestar essas contas, né? Isso
tem stolen money passes through hundreds of those small accounts, making it harder for us to track the money, he says. Cyber criminals don't target only big companies. In fact, almost one in four Brazilians have been victims of cybercrime, some even multiple times. Isabel Cristina de Camargo is a retired teacher who lives in the São Paulo metro area. In May, she got a WhatsApp message saying she had a lot of points to redeem on her credit card. She clicked on the link but couldn't redeem the points. The next day, she got a WhatsApp call showing her bank's logo.
Ela falou, não, a senhora quer resgatar, eu resgato para a senhora agora.
She told me, if you want to redeem your points, I can take care of it for you now, she says. Camargo was told to log into her bank account.
Clica aí, eu clicava. Até que chegou uma hora, clica aí.
She said, click here, and I did. And then she said, now you type your password, she says. Camargo was told to do the same with another account. In only a few minutes, she lost about $700. That's more than her monthly pension.
Mudei muito. Eu tenho até medo do celular, se você quer
I
saber.
Changed a lot. I'm even afraid of my cell phone. I put it in silence and I don't pick up calls anymore, she says. Brazil is number one in the whole world in phishing via WhatsApp.
WhatsApp, there's 100 types of different schemes. So whatever you came up with a business, there is a way that I can use it as a scheme.
Wanderson Castillo is the CEO of the cybersecurity firm Anetsec. One of the reasons cybercrime is so big in Brazil is because Brazilians are huge adopters of the internet. More than 90% of households here are connected to the web. And online banking is extremely popular, particularly using Pix, an instant payment system similar to Zelle. Castillo says criminals have moved from the physical to the digital space.
It's cheaper, it's less dangerous for them, and when they get caught, the jail time is much, but much, a way shorter than the physical one.
Even Castillo's cousin, Luciene Coene, has been a victim of a scam recently.
Eu sempre estou ouvindo as coisas que ele posta no TikTok.
I follow my cousin on TikTok, on Instagram. I knew a lot about schemes. I shouldn't have been a victim, she says. Coene fell for two consecutive schemes via WhatsApp in April, impersonating her daughter and her bank. She lost $5,000.
Principalmente, acabou comigo a maneira como eu fui tratada, que a polícia não deu bola nenhuma.
It was particularly hard because of how I was treated. The police didn't care. I filed a report just to show it to the bank. The bank didn't care either, she says. The police's cybercrime division doesn't deal with most small thefts. Those are investigated by local precincts. Cybercrime in Brazil exploded in part because of COVID, as people started doing everything online.
O bug no sistema é o usuário.
The user is the weak link, says Carlos Afonso da Silva. He's the IT director of the São Paulo Civil Police.
Se a gente fosse levar ao pé da letra, a pessoa para ter um telefone celular ia ter que tirar
In a perfect world, Silva jokes, people should get permits to do different things with their cell phones, from just making calls to using a smartphone for banking and shopping. There are just 20,000 police officers to cover the whole state of São Paulo, and they receive 3 million police reports a year, Silva says.
20 mil homens para investigar o estupro, a violência doméstica.
20,000 men to investigate rape, domestic violence, hijacking, digital crime ends up being less, he says. Many believe things will get worse as cybercrime doesn't have borders. Experts say many of the gangs in Brazil have connections with others in the U.S. and Africa. For the world, I'm Gisele Regatao, São Paulo, Brazil.
Tomorrow, August 6, marks 80 years since the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan. Be with us on The World when we'll look at the legacy of that terrifying day and how it continues to influence Japanese nuclear and defense policy. That's tomorrow on the show.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you, as always, for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private...